All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we are doing a deeper dive on the Falcons Week 2 preseason action against the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm answering your preseason, roster, and regular season questions as well.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, I'm Aaron Freeman. I've been covering the Atlanta Falcons for over a decade at FalcFans.com. You can find me on Twitter at FalcFans and, of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, we could call this a Mailbag Monday. We usually do our Q&As at the end of the week, at least normally, just sort of to fill out the week. But I thought it was a good opportunity, instead of me spending 45 minutes talking about things on the about the Falcons' second preseason game against the Chiefs that maybe you guys aren't as interested in. I would ask you guys specifically what you were interested in. I fished for questions on Sunday on Twitter, and if you're not on Twitter, then you probably should be, because I do a lot of interacting on Twitter. And if you only join Twitter to follow me at FalcFans or to follow the show at Locked On Falcons, I think it's going to be well worth your while, because there's good information that you can get from there. But in addition to Twitter, of course, you can always check us out on Facebook. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. The email address is lockedonfalcons@mail.com. You can always check out the great content at lockedonfalcons.com or falcfans.com, where the podcast is posted daily. So without further ado, let's jump into these questions. Our first question comes from Mao at Baldy ATL. He asks, what did you see out of Foyer and Oliver? I thought Foyer was pretty solid. I think there were a couple of times where his youth and lack of experience were to blame for him being a little bit out of position versus the run and occasionally in coverage. That TD to Kareem Hunt that was nullified by a penalty early in the game, I think he was the culprit out of position on that play to cover the flat, but I don't really know. It could have been Keanu Neal's fault, depending on whether the Falcons were in man coverage or in a matchup zone. Given the result, you know, I usually give the veteran the benefit of the doubt, particularly instances when it's a rookie. So I'm assuming Keanu Neal knew his assignment, but the rookie didn't. So I'll blame a little bit of Foyer Olakun on that instance. Other than that, the one thing that sort of stood out to me in my mind rewatching the game was there was one snap where I thought he did a pretty good job covering Travis Kelce in man coverage. Now, being able to cover Travis Kelce for one snap doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be able to do so in a real game for 40 snaps, but it certainly was promising for me. As for Isaiah Oliver, I thought his technique and awareness were off throughout the game. He missed at least one tackle, if not two, and I think was out of position on multiple throws. A couple of them were completely off the mark, so he didn't give up a completion, but he got beat on the go route for the touchdown, where he whiffed on the jam that I think everybody noticed. Then he got beat on another go route earlier in the game where Chad Henne threw it out of bounds. But that too would have been a big gain against him. And then there was a deep comeback at some point where the ball again was thrown out of bounds, but he was really out of position on that one. That would have been a significant gain as well. Regular listeners know that I've been all about tempering expectations for Oliver since we drafted him. But I'll be honest, that I thought his performance against the Chiefs was very underwhelming, even given my lower expectations. But that being said, I'm not going to overreact to one poor performance. But I was thinking that he'd probably be a little bit better to date than what he has been. So I'll certainly be very curious to see what improvements, if any, he makes over the rest of the preseason. And if we can see a brief flash or two of that upside that we are all intrigued by when we drafted him against Jacksonville or Miami. Mal's next question is, does Kazee have any chance of stealing the starting free safety spot from Ricardo? I would say no, not really, at least not in 2018, possibly in 2019. I think really the only chance of Kazee being, you know, the starter is if Allen gets hurt and misses multiple games, and in those games Kazee plays lights out. And you know, like this scenario would be like, let's imagine that Ricardo Allen misses four games due to a hamstring strain, and Kazee managed to snag like two or three interceptions in those games and break up a bunch of passes and, you know, make a bunch of splash plays in that game. Then I could imagine the scenario when Allen is back healthy off of those four games. They're like slow to bring him back because they're like quote unquote worried that he's going to re-aggravate his injury. And so in those instances, KZ will continue to get starts. And then maybe, you know, that turns into five and six straight starts to seven or eight. Like, but that's to me the only real scenario. I don't think that's really a thing that the Falcons are too concerned with. I think they actually are in love with the fact that they have four good safeties, four arguably starting caliber safeties, if you throw Parker and KZ into the mix alongside Allen and Neal. I don't think it's really about, you know, who are the best two. I think it's about how do they find ways to get three, if not all four of those guys on the field as much as possible this year. So, you know, whether KZ or Allen is starting, I think is something that's sort of, you know, it's irrelevant, I guess you could say. Our next question comes from Your Grace at Told You That on Twitter. He asks, want to know more about Wimbush. From what I hear from at Everett G07, he has been quietly solid. I thought Wimbush has been quietly solid. I think of the non-lock players to make the roster on the front seven, or on the defensive line, I'm sorry, and those are eight guys that we've talked about. Tack, Vic, Grady, Crawford, Shelby, Brooks Reed, Sanat, and McLean. Those guys are eight locks. But I think of the, you know, certainly among the edge guys, I think Wimbush has been the best of the group. He's no Cap Cappy by any means. But he's is a poor man's version of him. I think his first step quickness is really good. He's had a couple of opportunities to drop into coverage, like on some, like one or two times, I think, in the preseason. I thought he's done a decent job when he's been asked to do that, which goes back to what I was saying early this summer when we broke down the undrafted free agents, where I thought Wimbush might have a higher, bigger ceiling or a higher floor maybe as a linebacker than as a pure defensive end. But I think he's done some positive things against the run, and he's held up better, much better there than I initially thought he would coming into the summer. So I think there are positive signs for him. I think right now he's a long shot to make the roster unless there's an injury between Tack, Vic, or Brooks Reed going into the season. But I think he's a pretty strong bet to make the practice squad at this point. We got more to come, but I know you guys love listening to this podcast, but I think you guys should start checking out Locked On NFL Podcast with host Matt Williamson, because that show is right up your alley. Matt has a jam-packed weekly schedule set up for this season with local experts coming on the show on Mondays. He's got Sage Rosenfels, formerly of the Locked On Vikings podcast and has played several years in the NFL, coming on the show on Tuesdays. Wednesdays, you have Pro Football Focus's Mike Renner. Thursdays, you're going to have ESPN's Mike Sando joining Matt as well. So again, that's the Locked On NFL podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. All right, next up we have Evan Birchfield, at Evan Birchfield on Twitter. He says, I'm driving the Celestine hype train, want to climb aboard. Sure, I'll jump on that hype train, I guess, or I'll jump on the bandwagon. I'm not going to start pushing the hype train. I think he's been impressive so far this preseason. I thought his tackling was really good against the Chiefs. I thought among the backups, he was the only guy that was a sure tackler, after you got past the second string. I feel like some of the hype has been pushed a little bit because he's made some splash plays, and what's lost is that other guys sort of freed him up to make some of those plays. Like there was a play against the Jets where Wimbush got great push blowing up a double team, and that forced, was very disruptive, and Celestine shot the gap behind Wimbush and made the tackle for loss on that play. And, you know, Celestine's name goes into the box score and goes in, and is the guy that makes the big play and the tackle that everybody notices, but very few people see a guy like Wimbush blowing up that play and creating for him. But I do think of the, you know, we have five linebackers that everybody thought going into the summer were virtual locks to make the team. I think Celestine has been the best of the rest, and it goes back to what we said when he got signed, you know, like a week into training camp, is like, you can't always just assume that these guys that, you know, haven't been through the offseason program are just camp bodies. And I think Celestine has made a strong push to potentially make the 53-man roster as a sixth linebacker, but at the very least should be a strong bet to make the practice squad. I'm willing to jump on the bandwagon as far as being a pro Jonathan Celestine guy, but I'm not necessarily going to drive the hype train quite yet. You know, I want to see a little bit more. And, you know, so far he has shown improvements each week, I think. So, you know, if he can do that a third week, then, you know, you might have to step aside, Evan. Next question comes from Johnny Kinsley at Brickwall Blitz. He asked, this year, is this the year that Grady Jarrett finally gets selected to a Pro Bowl? This may be an overly logical way of breaking this down and answering this question, but it's due to the fact that I don't necessarily care too much about the Pro Bowl, but I think you got to figure that Grady Jarrett's name is in the hat alongside guys like Fletcher Cox, Aaron Donald, Ndamukong Suh, Gerald McCoy, Kawan Short, Sheldon Richardson, and maybe DeForest Buckner as like the front runners to be one of the three interior linemen selected to the NFC Pro Bowl squad. You know, if old school Mo Wilkerson shows up for the Packers this year, I guess you could probably also throw his name into the hat as well. I wouldn't necessarily bet on Grady Jarrett making the Pro Bowl this year, just because I don't see him as quite as capable a pass rusher as some of those other guys. And so much of the Pro Bowl is about how many sacks you get, as opposed to, you know, being this disruptive force against the run. Otherwise, Damon Harrison should make the Pro Bowl every year, because you could argue that he's as dominant a run defender as Aaron Donald is a pass rusher. If you were to basically tell me that, you know, I would, among those guys I named, I would probably say, like, yeah, if you said Grady Jarrett has like the sixth best odds of those interior linemen in the NFC, I would be like, yeah, I think I can buy that. And then basically you just have to argue that three of the five guys ahead of him, you know, will miss the mark this year. And I think, you know, we know that can happen due to injuries. You know, who knows what's going to happen with Aaron Donald's situation at this point, and whether that affects his play. You know, it's not as if Ndamukong Suh is a slam dunk to thrive in the Wade Phillips scheme, given that he's going to be playing a lot of nose tackle this year, if I'm not mistaken. Gerald McCoy has, you know, been nicked up the last like 4 or 5 years, so he's no safe bet. And Fletcher Cox and Kawan Short, the other two guys ahead of Grady Jarrett on that in terms of the top five or six, I wouldn't necessarily are slam dunks to make it either, although Cox, I think, has made it 3 years in a row. And then you figure, like, somebody, one of these guys is likely to sort of skip the Pro Bowl simply because their team might be in the Super Bowl. You know, obviously, I think people hope that's the Falcons, but the Rams are a front runner. The Eagles are a major team. The Packers, if you want to throw Mo Wilkerson into that mix, are a team that people think are going to be vying at the highest levels. Sheldon Richardson, you know, for the Vikings as well. So you never know. So I think there's a decent chance that Grady Jarrett makes the Pro Bowl. I wouldn't say it's a great chance, but it's decent. You know, anything could happen. Kai Ching at Falcon in Hawaii. This preseason has shown flashes of talented players on the Falcons roster, but one player sticks out like a sore thumb, Duke Riley. His bad reads and tackling angles are terrible. Do you see him as a developmental player like Rico, or as someone who is just a special teamer? Speaking at least in terms of the Chiefs game, I think the notion that Duke Riley took a bad angle on that swing pass to Kareem Hunt, I think, is vastly overblown and so nitpicky that it's not even funny. Like, I think he basically did the same thing that Brian Poole did on that crossing route to Tyreek Hill when he delivered that huge blow that everybody was up in arms about, which was a great play. But because Poole made the play, like, no one was like talking about, hey, he took a questionable angle there when he did that thing. So again, I know some people will be like, but, you know, and pointing out the subtle differences between but the point is, like, I think sort of being like he took a horrible angle on that play, I think it's not true. I think it's he made a split second decision, overestimating his speed. And at the moment when he made that decision, taking that was the shortest path to making the stop, because at that point I think Hunt was like 5 yards in the backfield, and sort of going over the top is just, you know, that's not what you're asking here though. Taking a deeper look at Duke Riley, I think his play was improved this week. I think his tackling was much better. I think his effort was better. One of the things that Dan Quinn has sort of talked about throughout the summer was whether players are hesitating because they don't know what they're doing or because of lack of effort. And I think from the coaching staff's perspective, if it's you're not knowing what you're doing, then they can fix that. But if it's from a lack of effort, they can't really fix that. And I think when you look at Duke Riley's performance against the Chiefs, I think the effort was there. I think, you know, he still needs work with the reading, the recognizing, the instincts, those sorts of things. You know, he was being asked to call the defense in the game. So I do think, given that he was given those responsibilities and still showed improvement this past week, I think that's a positive sign for him. You know, and I think one of the reasons why I'm so defensive of Duke Riley is I feel like people tend to vilify him for going through some of the same growing pains that pretty much every linebacker goes through, including Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell, and pretty much every rookie linebacker that the Falcons have had since maybe Jesse Tuggle, who, you know, was a rookie when I was like 6 years old and wasn't watching football or the Falcons. So I can't really speak to that. But for some reason, when Duke Riley has these same growing pains, it's unacceptable when he's going through them. I think to answer your question, Kai, I think it's too early to tell with Duke. I think he could be a backup or special teamer. He could be a developmental starter in the future, similar to Ricardo Allen. That takes, you know, a bit to get things going. You know, I'm certainly not as optimistic as I once was that he would be a capable starter. And I think, you know, a year ago I was, less than a year ago, I was saying like Duke Riley has the potential to be the best linebacker on the team back during a portion of 2017 when I was particularly down on the performances of Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell during that stretch run against AFC East opponents, where, again, if you go back and watch those games on film, you're not going to come away, or at least I didn't, and I don't think if you're paying attention, you would come away very impressed about the skills of Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell in those games. So, it speaks to sort of there are ups and downs with every player. Unfortunately for Duke Riley, there's been way more downs than ups, and I think that's being held against him a little bit more than anything. But that being said, like, yeah, going back to do I think he's going to be the best linebacker on the team? You know, I pumped the brakes on that, you know, that take at this point now that we've had a couple of months to sort of see a little bit more of that. But I think with Duke Riley, I think I would stress patience. I think, frankly, whether or not he turns into that, whatever you think he's going to be or whatever you think he should be, doesn't really matter all that much this year, just because I don't think having a high-level third linebacker is all that important given how deep and talented the Falcons secondary is. And I think they can somewhat offset any issues that Duke Riley or Kamal Ishmael or Foye Olakun have as that third linebacker by deploying Keanu Neal as a box safety, as a de facto linebacker, by putting three safeties on the field, whether it's Casey or Parker, or, you know, if Oliver's place improves, putting him out there. Brian Poole is basically a safety out there and is one of the team's most consistent run defenders going back the last two seasons. So he's practically as good as any sort of 202-pound linebacker you could find out there in the league. So regardless of whether Duke, I guess that's part of the reason why I'm a little bit more willing to be patient with Duke Riley, because I think ultimately him disappointing me is not that big of a disappointment. So we got more standout players to talk about further on this podcast, but I do want to take a moment to plug some of my own content on the LockedOnFalcons.com. It's Monday, and you guys should check out my update on 7 key position battles going on during the preseason coming off of the heels of this Chiefs game. Those position battles include the fullback position, backup tight end, starting right guard, swing tackle, weak side linebacker, third cornerback, and return specialist. So head on over to LockedOnFalcons.com right now, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. All right, our next question comes from Max Richolds, at Max Richolds on Twitter. No offense, Max, it's just Richards and Richolds is hard to say, weird. Anyway, there's nothing wrong with your name. It's just I want to say Richards, but I have to stress the L. Can you also talk about Marvin Harrell, please? What the game showed about his prospects for making the team and how he'll be used if he does. I think Hall has been a strong bet to make the roster as a 6th wide receiver, you know, if many of you go back to the early spring, part of the reason why I was sort of anti Ridley and anti drafting a wide receiver high, because I had a very high opinion of Marvin Hall, thinking that he could sort of step in and be that fourth option, if need be, if the Falcons can just continue to develop him. But I think, you know, he's going to a strong bet to make the roster. Whether you consider him to be the fifth or sixth wide receiver is based off of whether how you categorize Russell Gage. But, you know, right now he's been utilized primarily as Julio's main backup at that X wide receiver spot. And he'll probably get, you know, a healthy amount of work this year when Julio needs a breather, which usually is about 20% of the snaps. Julio plays about 80 to 85% of the snaps the last couple of years when healthy. And, you know, that amounts to maybe about 5 or 10 snaps per game, which is about what he got for portions of last season when he was active on the roster. I could see Hall getting more targets in those limited opportunities, but you're still probably talking about a guy that's topping out around 10 or 15 catches this year. But I do think a lot of those plays could be shot plays down the field. That's something that the Falcons utilized him quite a bit last year. And, you know, instead of utilizing Taylor Gabriel in that role, they utilized Marvin Hall quite a bit in that role. And I suspect that even with the absence, with the departure of Gabriel, you're still likely to see that. I would sit here and also say that I think the Falcons, if the season started tomorrow, I think Hall would open the season as the team's kick and punt returner. I feel like he's the guy that if they have a horse in the race, he would be the guy right now. But I think we're going to have to see how the return specialist battle plays out over the next 2 weeks. I think at this point, it's still a toss-up. It's probably the most unknown of these roster battles, including the six other ones that I wrote about on LockedOnFalcons.com. You know, and so, you know, if the season started tomorrow, I think Hall would open the season as the team's, you know, return specialist. But the season doesn't start tomorrow. We got two more games to really decide that. So that could certainly affect his usage, because I think if he is that return specialist, then there's, you know, pretty much a guarantee that he's going to be active every week. If he isn't, then there might be some games where he's inactive, and maybe a lot of games this year where he's inactive and only plays when there is another player ahead of him being injured. So that'll be something to monitor. But again, we'll have to figure that out as, you know, these next couple of games wear on. Tayback at Brazil Guy on Twitter asks, "Hi Aaron, what did you think of offensive play calling Riley and Sanat? They might be the biggest question marks on my head." Well, I already answered sort of Riley already. Let's talk about the play calling. I didn't think much of the play calling because it's a preseason game, but I do one observation I will make is I thought it was pretty funny that I saw some people, you know, during the game tweeting about how great the play calling was, as well as sort of calling out the anti-Sark people for the Falcons, you know, success early in that game against the Chiefs. And I guess technically I would probably qualify as an anti-Sark person, because there's been so much criticism of Sark over the last 11 months on this podcast. But I think one of my issues that I've had with Sark, and being a little bit too quick to praise him based off of Friday's performance — again, it's a preseason game, so we shouldn't be reading anything into it, but let's go ahead and read something into it. Particularly looking at that first big play to Hooper on that first third down of the game. And this is sort of what I was talking about on, I think it was Thursday's episode, when we talked about Matt Ryan and the whole Jalen Ramsey thing. But part of that conversation we had was, you know, Matt Ryan has made significant strides with his ability to extend plays. And that play to Hooper on Friday was a good example of that. And it's too often you're relying on Matt Ryan to do what he did on that play to sort of drive the offense, as opposed to the design of the play initially. And, you know, a lot of people talk about sort of the lack of execution being the downfall of the Falcons offense last year. And I think that is overblown, but I would say in terms of execution, I think the major issue is too often this team is relying on Matt Ryan essentially to basically look like Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson, like he did on that play, in order for them to be able to move the chains and generate some of these big explosive plays. And for those of you that are relatively new listeners, I should let you know that I'm a big believer that there is a very strong correlation, if not downright causation, between being an explosive offense and being a very productive offense. And so, you know, it, to me, it's not a coincidence that the Falcons offense looked really good on those opening series and was able to move the ball down into the red zone. And they also had explosive plays on that. So that's what I'll say. Now, you know, as I said on Thursday, you know, Ryan is much better at sort of doing these extending plays, you know, looking, he looks more like Aaron Rodgers today than he did, say, in 2010, but I don't know how reliable that's going to be throughout the season. Now, that being said, where I will praise Sark is with this, and I think one of the things I did notice watching the game, rewatching the game, was in the first half, how many instances the Falcons used bunch and or stat concepts. And when bunch, what I'm typically referring to is when you get three receivers sort of lined up, you know, bunched together on one side of the field. And the stack concepts are when you get two receivers, typically in the slot, one lined up, you know, right behind the other guy. And basically the lead guy's release is able to get the second guy a free release and prevents teams from playing press coverage. You know, in terms of utilizing those concepts and utilizing those complementary route combinations that come off of these, where you utilize one receiver or two receivers to create separation, create space for another receiver. Ridley's touchdown catch was an example of that. I can't remember who it was. I want to say it was Logan Paulson, or maybe it was Saubert. But one of those guys was basically able to run and attack the Chiefs zone, which opened up that underneath zone for Ridley to settle in and make the touchdown catch. And so, like, that was something that, to me, was sorely missing from Sark last season. And when he utilized it, I didn't think it was particularly effective when he utilized those stat concepts, particularly in comparison to how Shanahan utilized them. One of the first instances I noticed of sort of Shanahan's quote-unquote genius was in that Cowboys game back in 2015, where he utilized his stat concept with Julio and Hankerson and called it one way in, like, early in the game, I think in the third quarter, and then called it a very different way later in the game in the fourth quarter, and in both instances were sort of critical plays that set up scores and extended drives for the Falcons in that game, and was part of the reason why they were able to come back and win that game. As for Sanat, I thought Sanat was okay. Like, he didn't really stand out in a major way, either positively or negatively to me. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't really have any strong thoughts on him. In terms of calling him a question mark, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. You know, I'm not sure exactly what you mean, so I'm just going to make some assumptions about what you mean right now and address those. Maybe you're thinking about him in terms of whether he can adequately fill Dontari Poe's shoes, you know, and I don't want to necessarily write off Deidre Sanat too soon because, you know, we'll find out. But I think if you're expecting little to no drop-off between Dontari Poe, arguably a generational 3-4 nose tackle prospect when he was drafted in the first round back in 2012, a Pro Bowler, and, you know, Deidre Sanat, comparing that to Deidre Sanat, who probably 80% of you listening to me right now didn't even know who he was until we drafted him in round 3. Yeah, I think if you're thinking that's, you know, there's going to be little drop off between Poe and Sanat, I think you're probably setting your standards a little bit too high. I think there are going to be games this year where the Falcons are going to look very soft up the middle. That's been the case pretty much every year that Dan Quinn has been the head coach here. And whether it's been Paul Soliai or Dontari Poe or Sanat providing that beef in the middle, that's been the case. And I don't think, you know, if that was the case with Soliai and Poe, then why wouldn't it be also the case with a rookie like Sanat? But I also think, you know, outside of those handful of games, maybe 3 or 4 of those games, I don't think it's going to be to any significant enough degree where it won't be, the Falcons won't be able to overcome that issue. So, you know, in terms of, like, putting all this on Sanat in terms of, like, being the force in the middle, I wouldn't do that. I just don't think that's fair to do to a rookie. But, like, I think Sanat's fine, I guess, to answer your question. Max Richold's next question is, how do you see Sark using Ridley going forward with both Jones and Sanu mainly slot or outside, and how does Ridley match up against division opponents, particularly the Aints? I'm also sort of curious to see how he utilizes him. We haven't seen Jones, Sanu, and Ridley on the field at the same time so far in the preseason, so I can only speculate, make an educated guess. But, you know, I would assume right now that Ridley will spend a lot of time on the outside. He has gotten the bulk of his work so far in the preseason, either as a slot receiver or playing that Z flanker spot that Mohamed Sanu plays. It's basically Sanu's exact role with the team, so they're clearly sort of grooming him to replace Sanu at some point in the future, whether that's 2019 or 2020. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. One thing that stood out to me with Ridley against Kansas City was his success really depended on who was covering him. We saw him beat up David Amerson a couple of times, but when he was going up against Kendall Fuller, when he was lined up in the slot, not so much. And I think similarly to Sanu, even though it's going to be different matchups, I think similarly a lot of his success right now, based off of what we've seen so far with Ridley, is going to depend on what matchups he's going to face. And I think some of those bigger, stiffer corners like Amerson, he can run circles around, and we saw that on Friday. But, you know, guys like Fuller that can handle his speed and quickness, you know, he's probably not going to fare quite to the same level against those guys. Now, in terms of looking at the NFC South, you look at King Crawley is most likely going to be the guy that's going to line up against Ridley when he's on the outside, because Lattimore's going to shadow Julio, and Patrick Robinson is probably going to play in the slot against Sanu. Now, I think King Crawley is a solid player. It seemed to me, you know, he struggled in that first game against the Falcons, and I also struggled in the NFC Championship game, and I noticed in both of those games what the Falcons and Vikings did was try to attack him with a lot of sort of crossing routes, and that was something, you know, in that Falcon game was very effective against them when they would go man coverage and they would use crossing routes, and Sanu would use his body to position him. There was a couple times where Crawley fell down and the Falcons would sort of pick him and rub him. So I think, we saw Ridley do that in this Chiefs game with some of the crossing routes. So I think, you know, that could be a favorable matchup if the Falcons continue to do that. Against the Buccaneers, you know, Brent Grimes, I would assume, would be lining up primarily against him the majority of the time, on that left side of the defense, on the right side of the Falcons offense. Grimes is a smaller, quicker, you know, corner that tends to do well against smaller, quicker types of wide receivers like Ridley is. But, you know, at the same time, Brent Grimes is 35 and Father Time is undefeated. So eventually there's going to be some decline. So maybe Grimes is not going to necessarily be able to handle that matchup to as well as he could have 2-3 years ago. I also think Vernon Hargreaves would be a pretty good would have a decently favorable matchup against Ridley, just because Hargreaves is a better press guy than he is an off corner. But typically Mike Smith doesn't like his corners pressing all that much. We'll see if that changes this year. And so, you know, I wouldn't necessarily see that if Hargreaves is not allowed to press Ridley, then it wouldn't be a great matchup. It would be a favorable matchup for Ridley. I would say that. As for Carolina, given their question marks at the second cornerback spot opposite James Bradbury, I think, you know, it's a favorable matchup for Ridley. I would imagine that Carolina would ask James Bradbury to shadow Julio. I think that's something they've dabbled with in the past, not fully committed to, but have certainly dabbled with. And, you know, given their question marks at that second cornerback spot, I think that would be the smartest decision for them in any matchup with the Falcons receiver. It seems like right now, that Dante Jackson is set to be their second cornerback, and Jackson has a lot of speed, but I think watching him at LSU, I think speed is really his only trait, and I think he's pretty raw other than the fact that he's super, super fast. So I don't necessarily know if his speed would be as great an asset in the matchup against Ridley as it would be for other guys. Like if Brent Grimes could, you know, run a 4-3, then there's no way that, you know, he's shutting down Calvin Ridley. But Dante Jackson's running that sub 4-3 and not doing much else. I don't know if that's going to be that advantageous if your technique and awareness isn't up to par. But I also haven't been paying a ton of attention to what Jackson has done so far this preseason. So maybe he's better than my perception of what he was when he was at LSU. In terms of how to utilize Ridley, you know, we talked a little bit about the stack concepts, and I saw this on Twitter today from Ben_Fennell_NFL on Twitter. And, you know, I'll just basically read his tweet because I think it echoes sort of where I feel about it. He says, Calvin Ridley thoughts. Hide him with stacks, bunches, and tight alignments. Get him a free release ahead of steam. Double moves, yards after catch, catch run opportunities. Don't force him to beat press regularly. Don't force him to make tight window contested catches regularly. And I think that's basically Calvin Ridley in a nutshell. And if the Falcons do that, and they're, again, going back to what we talked about just a couple of minutes ago with sort of Stark utilizing more of those stack concepts and bunch concepts, you know, in this past week's performance, and if that's an indicator that that's something that they're going to utilize in the regular season, then things are pointing up for Calvin Ridley. So we'll see how that gets utilized this season. So, guys, that is it as far as questions go. I think I hinted that I would make some adjustments to my practice squad. As far as, you know, going back and looking at my 53-man roster projection that I had at the beginning of the summer before camp started, there aren't too many changes I would make to that. I think one of the things that we've talked about for regular listeners in terms of the roster breakdown, and this is something we'll go deeper on in future episodes, so if you're confused by exactly the context of what I'm talking about, I apologize, but if you continue to stay locked on Falcons, you will definitely understand exactly what I'm talking about. We've talked in the past about Kurt Benkert's ability to make the roster as sort of that 25th grab bag position, and right now, looking at the roster, I would think that 25th spot will come down to either Benkert as the third quarterback or a 10th offensive lineman. Now, I happen to be seemingly in the minority of opinion at thinking Sean Harlow is going to be one of the 9 offensive linemen that the Falcons make as a roster. But even if you don't think that, then throw Sean Harlow as that 10th offensive lineman. For my example, I think Matt Gano is that 10th offensive lineman that is making a push. And right now, if I was betting, I would say Gano is ahead of Benkert in terms of making that grab bag position. If you were flipping Gano as saying he's one of the 9 and Harlow's the 10th, I think right now Harlow is ahead of Benkert in terms of making the roster. So Benkert, I think, needs to make a stronger push. He's coming off a pretty lackluster performance against the Chiefs. And so we need to see him bounce back and look more like what he did against the Jets, and then maybe he can close the gap a little bit on that. As far as any other projections I had, I think I had Pastore making the roster over Ty Sambrelo. I still feel like Pastore is better than Sambrelo, but, you know, the Falcons always have to do one or two moves that tick me off. So if I was betting, I would say Sambrelo is probably ahead of him right now. I also had Garrison Smith and Richard Jarvis making the roster as well. I still feel like Garrison Smith is making a strong bid to be that 5th D tackle in the rotation, so I won't change that quite yet. That 6th linebacker that I had Richard Jarvis making, I think, is still a little bit up in the air. I don't necessarily know if Jarvis will make it there. Maybe it's JT Jones. I might switch it. Like, if you were asking me, I'd probably switch it with JT Jones right now. I think in terms of the guys that I had making the practice squad, I had Benkert making the practice squad. I'll stick to that. I had Malik Williams making the practice squad. Right now, I would probably say Justin Crawford is ahead of him right now. I had Dontez Bird making the practice squad. I still feel like Bird's got a pretty good shot, but right now I'm torn between him and Reggie Davis and Devin Gray and Christian Blake. I feel like all of those guys are sort of lumped into the same group, and I'm waiting to see a little bit more separation. So I guess I'd stick with Bird for the time being, but I feel like it's really anybody's spot at this point. I had tight end Troy Mangin making the practice squad, along with Alex Gray, but I'm not counting him because he's automatically in. I had Daniel Brunskill, Matt Gano, and J.C. Hassenauer, all 3 offensive linemen, making the practice squad. Right now, I'd probably say like Jamil Douglas makes it, maybe Brunskill, and probably still Hassenauer. But I would say of that group, I would say Brunskill is probably the most vulnerable of that group. Defensive line, I had John Cunningham making the practice squad. I still feel good about that. I had Anthony Wimbush making the practice squad as well. I feel still good about that. I had safety Tyson Graham making the practice squad. Now I would probably go push more towards Marcellus Branch than Graham at this point if a fifth safety is on the practice squad. And the one guy I left out, I probably put Celestin. So I probably right now I'd probably swap out Brunskill and put Celestin on the practice squad. So those would be your 10. So right now I would say the 10 likeliest practice squad guys are Binkert, Crawford, let's say Dontez Bird, let's say Troy Mangin, John Celestin, Jameel Douglas, J.C. Hassenauer, John Cunningham, Anthony Wimbush, and Marcellus Branch maybe. So yeah, that's probably where I would fall on the 10-man practice squad. And of course Alex Gray is the 11th guy. So just something to think about through two games. We're now one through phase one of the preseason. Next week is the big dress rehearsal game against the Jaguars. And we'll be talking about that later in the week, as well as coming up with other, you know, great Falcons content. Maybe some fan talks coming up this week. So anticipate that, I guess. So that's it, guys. Until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.